This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Let's come back to looking at the Reformation in France now. We mentioned the last hour of this massacre at Vassy and the response of the Protestants. And there are a number of attempts to try to bring peace and to see if they could encourage the cessation of armed conflict among one another. There are a number of the attempts they've tried to basically set aside a few what were called safe places in France where the Protestants could freely worship without being molested by the Catholic authorities in any way, but things just did not hold. They would have peace for a season and stop, and then there'd be a rebellion again, and Roman Catholics would react violently, and so it kind of was a vicious circle. One of the leaders among the Huguenots was Gaspard de Coligny, who's a war hero. He had been involved in some of the wars between France and Spain, and he actually was kind of a father figure, ironically, to Charles IX. This is Catherine de Medici's son, who's now the king of France. So he respected and admired this Protestant leader. And what Catherine de Medici did in wanting to consolidate her power and undermine the authority of Coligny and also the push for Protestant acceptance, is she is the mastermind behind the assassination of Coligny that happened in 1572. And what happened, you see this particular painting portrays the two different attempts. You'll see on the right-hand side the gunshot, which was not fatal, and were not able to kill him, but yet some men sent from Catherine de Medici get him in his bedroom and throw him out the window. You see that over on the other side. And he is murdered, and so her plot to assassinate him is fulfilled, and killing this acknowledged leader of the Huguenots, and after this murder, mobs began to form in the streets in Paris, and the Catholic populace began to a sense that this is a time we can push back against the Protestants. And beginning on that day, August 24th, 1572, the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, estimates are that in Paris in that day and in the day to follow, that the 4,000 Protestants were brutally killed. And it got so bad that the Catholic hordes, this is just a mass popular riot. They are gathering up Protestants and killing them. Bodies are just stacked up in the city of Paris. Charles IX, the king, is a bit horrified about this, even though his mother started all this to kill the Protestant leader. He actually gathered up a bunch of the Huguenots, put them in a prison to protect them from the mobs. The mobs stormed into the prison and killed all the Huguenots anyway. So you can see even the king himself is rather powerless to protect his subjects. Well, this is in 1572. This is going to set off another round of violent confrontation between the Protestants and the Catholics. Here you've got some papal medals celebrating St. Bartholomew's Day, the day of the killing of these Protestant heretics. And for Catholics, this was a great triumph when we were able to deal this significant blow to them. Well, back to our original map, you'll notice Well, I don't know. What color would you call that? It's not, almost looks pinkish on mine. Tan? You can see it. This is the Catholic League. These are the more Catholic areas. You'll see down here. Then the Huguenot-controlled province is in the green. And then provinces loyal to the king. Remember I told you how there were kind of three parties. And so France is rather divided. But the Catholic Party is getting stronger and stronger. And the Catholic League is growing in strength and is going to put more pressure on the Protestants to deal with this. Well, the outcome of the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre and in the weeks and months ahead, estimates are some as high as 100,000 Protestants may have been killed in that wave. You know, realistically, maybe more, 30 or 40,000, but, I mean, whatever the figure is, tens of thousands of Protestants are getting killed as a result of this. And as the Catholic League gets stronger and basically is going to force King Henry III, who's Catherine de Medici's third son, is force him from the throne, and he flees. Eventually, Henry III connects with another Protestant leader, Henry IV, Henry of Navarre. The Kingdom of Navarre, he is the King of Navarre, was a kind of a border state right here between Spain and France. And he is... has some claims to the royal throne, and Henry III and Henry IV of Navarre, this Protestant, is anointed king, and together they march on to Paris. Henry III is assassinated by a monk, and so Henry IV, this Protestant now, is going to become king. But guess what he does? Immediately upon ascending to the throne to be the new king, the next king of France, 1594, Henry IV, Henry of Navarre, he immediately converts to Roman Catholicism. The Catholic League embraces him as their sovereign. And what he does in this Edict of Nantes, which is just 4 years later, is he tries to establish a peaceful situation where now there are going to be 100 different safe places throughout France where the Protestants are able to freely worship without any harassment at all. So Henry IV, and there are debates historically about how genuine his conversion to Catholicism was, if it was, you know, purely political, or was there... some significant reflection on his part, but it certainly did resolve the immediate needs that he had to have the Catholic League support him. Well, the Edict of Nantes then is in force, allowing freedom of worship, 100 safe places, but it reestablishes Roman Catholicism as the official religion of the King of France. So, willing to make this more intentional connection to the papacy, but all of the parties were fatigued at this point because of the ongoing warfare. Well, to fast forward, we don't have time to tell all the story. To fast forward to 1685, we're kind of getting out of our immediate Reformation era, but just the way this story kind of spins out. Louis XIV, who is in his day is going to be the most powerful king in Europe, expanding his empire, feels threatened by these Huguenots. They continue to grow in numbers, and he basically is going to revoke the Edict of Nantes. And in violent persecution against now this huge number of Huguenots is going to begin. Estimates are that when the Edict of Nantes is revoked, there may have been as many as 700,000 Huguenots in France. So you see the proliferation of Protestantism in France, and this is moving on toward the end of the 17th century here. But when he outlaws Protestantism, basically they're given three choices. They can convert to Roman Catholicism, they can enter an underground church, which some of them did, just have to worship in secret, or flee, are the kind of the options they had. But then he forbade Huguenots to flee his realm. He wanted to force them to reconvert to Catholicism. And those who refuse to abjure, or those who attended illegal underground services, or perhaps leaving, were caught leaving the kingdom, they were sentenced to the galleys, may have been deported, and some of them executed. But as many as 500,000 of these Huguenots renounced their faith and just found it easier to stay. They had their homes established there in France and outwardly at least conformed to Roman Catholicism. And if you read some of the stories of what happened there, you know, they tried. Some of the priests sometimes would compromise with some of the Huguenots. The Huguenots, you know, did not want last rites given to them by the Catholic Church, and so you get an idea that they were trying to hold on to some semblance of their Protestant convictions. But here you've got one of the quote booted missionaries of Louis XIV, and they really did go about forcing these Huguenots. Now, of the 200,000 Huguenots who fought their fate, many of them will be sentenced over the next 100 years and forced into servitude on the French galley ships. You know, a lot of people suffered from this. John Knox is going to be end up having to serve in the French galley ships for a season himself. But it's a horrible story. In the long term, the Huguenots in mass numbers, for those that didn't reconvert to Catholicism, are going to flee France. And for all practical purposes, the Protestant movement in France is snuffed out. Eventually, there are going to be very small pockets of this, but Huguenots will go into England. You can see the Netherlands, some going into South Africa. You see this even at the time of Louis XIV. And then you've got some that come over to this country. Many of you, perhaps, if you've been to Charleston, have seen the historic Huguenot church in Charleston. Huguenots, as they would come over to this country, either affiliated with the Dutch Reformed churches or, in the early years, Puritans. Some of them kept their ethnic distinctives. But more and more, the Huguenots just dispersed into the population in the American colonies. A lot of them with that Reformed heritage connected with Dutch Reformed, Presbyterian churches. And you just don't have a significant distinctive Huguenot Protestant presence in America, as they were just dispersed all over Europe. Well, a sobering story of what transpired in the Reformation in France, eventually where the tens of thousands of these Huguenots are spread all over Europe. So tolerated for a while after the period of war, 80 or 90 years, and then the hammer comes down on the Huguenots. It's interesting. I often have students, you know, tell me, you know, I'm from Huguenot heritage. We have a lot of people in America, if you trace it back far enough. You know, we've had one African-American student who's got Huguenot heritage in his lineage. And I always tell them that's a proud lineage, because it was the horrible thing that happened to these French Protestants during this time. Well, let's move over to the Reformation in Holland and look at what happened here. This is the other area where Calvinistic doctrines and polity prospered. Now, the good news about the Netherlands, I'm going to tell you about the bloody story, and the similar kind of situation is what happened in France in terms of the armies facing off one another. But long term, in Holland, a Reformed church is going to be established, particularly in the northern provinces. So while the French Protestants tried to do it and established themselves in this provincial synods for, 150 years, it ultimately came to naught, which would not be the case in the Netherlands. The early years, Lutheran influence, same kind of thing, just like France with the Lutheran documents and ideas coming into the Netherlands. You could see how that would be very easily could happen geographically because of where they live. And then, as we saw with telling the Anabaptist story, there's a period of Anabaptist influence, particularly in the decade of the 1530s. And then beginning in the 40s, more Calvinistic influence. Now, you note this is beginning with the period after Calvin goes to Geneva. So the Calvinism is going to be the dominant expression of Protestantism in the Netherlands, but there were other influences in those years. So we'll talk about that influence there, and we're going to talk about the ongoing war with Spain in the Netherlands, and then this Peace of Westphalia in 1648, and then we'll see if we get to it today. We'll talk a little bit about the important doctrinal controversy which comes out of the Netherlands in the Canons of Dort, which long-term will help define a part of the Reformed tradition in some pretty significant ways. Well, the Netherlands, as you'll recall, had been a part of this debated political tense-filled area between Francis I and Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor. And so the Netherlands had long-term had some Spanish connections there, and particularly under Charles V, wanting to claim hegemony there in the Netherlands. And being committed to the Roman Catholic faith, both Charles V and his successor, Philip II, will, under the Inquisition and the auspices of Spain, and Spaniard's presence in the Netherlands, will kill large numbers of Protestants there in Spain. And again, if you look at the influences there, you've got the German Lutheran influence here, some of the Anabaptist influence and up in some of these areas in Germany, particularly in the Friesland, here in the islands off of the Netherlands, and then in an area called Emden. In Germany, you would have some of the refugees that would have to flee because of some of the Spanish persecution. But eventually, they're going to have a face-off. There you've got Emden. If you can see that, E-M-D-E-N. It's a place in northwest Germany where some of the early Calvinists hid out, if you would, and were refugees in this more Lutheran area, but were able to worship there. But eventually they're going to grow in numbers and be able to stand up against the Catholics. Well, we already looked at here's Charles V and Philip II, his successor, the King of Spain. And Philip is the baton is passed on to him, and he is going to have the same vision that Charles V has, that I am the protector of the Roman Catholic Church, and with all the territory under my dominion, I'm going to enforce the Roman Catholic faith, just like Charles V wanted to do in the Holy Roman Empire and throughout his domain. So the Spaniards are going to remain staunchly Roman Catholic through this whole era of the Reformation. Now, this is the map we looked at with the showing the spread of Anabaptists, and remember we talked about them being in the Netherlands, and Menno Simons and his unique work. Now, odd twists of history in terms of the prevalence of Protestantism, and particularly the Calvinistic faith in the Netherlands, is in the early years, it was in Antwerp and Ghent that there were pockets of Protestants in more of the southern area of the Netherlands. Long term, it's going to be up in the north where Protestantism will be strong and the Catholics will maintain control of this area. Yeah, the whole north-south thing throughout Europe is kind of interesting, you know, geographically and politically, how all this played out. Whether you're talking about Germany, if you're talking about Europe as a whole, you talk about the outcome of the 30 Years' War, what ended up happening in Holland, with all the give and take in Protestant Catholic armies fighting against each other in the 16th and into the 17th century, long term, the Catholics will hold the South and the Protestants will hold the North. And as deep as they're able to go into the territory of the other one, eventually they cannot hold it and they push them back again. And there, you know, we're talking about 150 years of wars. And long term, it ends up being just like it was in the early years of the Reformation. With the Catholic South. I mean, you think about it, picture it in your mind. Italy stays Catholic. Spain stays Catholic. France stays Catholic. Where are the Protestant groups? In the north. And the 30 Years' War did not turn the corner on that long term. And so Holland is kind of, in the Netherlands, is kind of a microcosm of what happened throughout all of Europe in terms of the north-south thing, no matter where Protestantism begins. Same thing in France. You notice how the Protestants are real strong in southern France for a season. But yet they're going to be obliterated from that area eventually. All right. Reformed churches in the Netherlands and the Palatinate. And I mentioned that when we looked a little bit earlier here. Up, you can see the proliferation of them up in the Netherlands and in France. Here's the Palatinate. Now, the Palatinate's going to be important because of some connections between the Netherlands and some of these and the German-speaking Reformed and some of the refugees that will have to leave the Netherlands at different times. We'll spend some time in the Palatinate, and some of the doctrinal statements that are produced by the Reformed churches here will end up being very important in the Netherlands. So there is kind of a connection here. Also, all right. One of the turning points in the story of the Reformed churches in the Netherlands are the iconoclastic riots in 1566, which produced in the year that followed what is known in Dutch Reformed history as the Wonder Year. Because of the revolt and riots of these Protestants in different parts of the Netherlands, that they were actually given a tolerance in the years 1566 and 1567, and able to freely worship and to expand their churches and that kind of thing. But it was very short-lived. Philip II in 1567 sends the infamous Duke of Alba with 10,000 Spanish troops into the Netherlands to violently suppress these Protestants, and basically brings the Inquisition with them. A lot of these people are killed. They're put in prison. Here you see this painting of the Duke of Alba with these Protestants in chains, and are bringing them before the Inquisitors. So the Inquisition makes its way into the Netherlands. This is one of the points where there are a lot of exiles, not only back into Emden, Northwest Germany, many of them go over to London also and cross the sea and are able to escape from the persecution in that way. One of the Protestant leaders, William of Nassau, the Prince of Orange, he has had to flee, but is able to rally a Protestant army, and they are able to march back into the Netherlands, into the north, and capture the city of Brill. You can see that William of Orange and the Calvinists capture a foothold in 1572 in the city of Brill. So you've got a rather strong Protestant army with these Catholics, armies, the Duke of Alba and his troops here, and now the Protestants are gaining momentum and force. And the Civil War is restarted again. And there are war councils and a popular Calvinist revolution is taking place. And a couple of other things I've got marked on the map here. 1576, the pacification of Ghent. Basically where they try to, for a very short window, the Catholics and the Protestants together in the Netherlands agree to try to run the Spanish out. And so because of that ethnic and national pride, they do not want the Spaniards in the Netherlands. But that is very short-lived. Spain is going bankrupt at this time with trying to expand its empire. Many of the Spaniards leave. And so this temporary peace between Catholics and Protestants is very short-lived. Eventually, the Catholic areas reconsolidate in this Union of Eros in 1579. And then in the north, you're going to have a Protestant union, the Union of Utrecht. In 1579, seven northern provinces declare independence from Spain. And this is going to be the beginnings of what would become the state Dutch church in Holland, the beginnings of it, now in the northern provinces, in beginning now in 1579. So you've got, again, Protestant and now Catholic unions facing off against each other. And in the north, trying to establish a national Dutch church. Okay, 1584, William of Orange is assassinated by a Catholic fanatic. So you've got the Protestant leader here killed. And then in southern Netherlands, you've got the Spaniards reconquer by 1585 the southern area. And so that is going to be a strong line of demarcation there, north and south. Long term, by 1585, you're going to have the establishment of the a national Dutch church in the states there in Holland, and then the Catholics in the south, which, you know, eventually will become Belgium. So Protestant and Catholic areas there in the Netherlands. Now, as far as some of their confessional documents, and this is, I guess, for those of us of the Reformed tradition, it's important we at least have some connectors to these historical documents. Most of you have probably heard of the Heidelberg Catechism. You may not have be as familiar with the Belgic Confession, but let me tell you where those documents came from and why they are associated with the Dutch Church. Now, the Belgic Confession was actually written by a Frenchman, Guido de Bry, in 1561. And he eventually is going to be a martyr for his faith. It was based upon the Gallican Confession. And he was attempting to basically, through the Belgic Confession, demonstrate for the Spanish authorities that the Reformed Church, that they were law-abiding citizens, they were not Anabaptists or rebels. And he kind of lays out a Reformed doctrines there. But notice, by the next year, it is translated into Dutch, and it will be adopted by the Synod of Antwerp in 1566, and again reconfirmed by the Synod of Dort in 1619. So the Belgic Confession, at least for the Dutch Reformed tradition, is one of their very, very important documents. Again, based much of it on the Gallican Confession of John Calvin. One of the contributions of there are many contributions. It's a great historical document, but one distinctive of the Belgic Confession, you might notice, it's one of the earliest Reformed statements of faith, which is very definitive about including the church discipline as one of the marks of the church. Up until this time, most certainly the Lutherans and most Calvinists, and when it came specifically to talk about what are the marks that distinguished the true church, it was the preaching of the word and the proper administration of the sacraments. But now in the Belgic Confession, they add, and the legitimate administration of discipline, or the practice of discipline, I should say. And so some of the Reformed churches in other parts of Europe and certainly Britain will latch onto that. But the Belgic Confession is very important. And then this fascinating catechism known as the Heidelberg Catechism. And there are parts of that that are very popular. It is more pastoral in tone and tempting to be winsome, I guess you could say, in its articulation of the Reformed faith. But it has an interesting history. It goes back to some of the discussions in the 1550s in this area known as the Palatinate. Remember I talked about that this German realm within the larger, among the larger German princes that had embraced some of the Reformed churches, and there was a Lutheran influence there also, and Frederick III, the prince, wanting to have peace and unity among his subjects, asked two men, Ursinus and Olivianus, at the University of Heidelberg, in the 1560s, to to write this Heidelberg Catechism. And they followed the outline of the book of Romans. But it's very pastoral and basically an attempt to teach the faith. It tends to be non-polemical, not attacking anybody, but a moderate expression of the Reformed faith. And you don't find as much emphasis on the rigid view of predestination. I mean, it's there, but not as much emphasis on it. And it would have great influence in the Netherlands. And it was translated by 1568, translated into to Dutch. And Dutch by 1586, Dutch ministers would subscribe to the Heidelberg Catechism. And in some of the American Dutch churches, like the RCA, the Reformed Church of America, or the CRC, the Christian Reformed Church, you will hear them talk about the three forms of unity, the three forms of unity among Dutch Reformed Calvinists, and that is the Belgic Confession, the Heidelberg Catechism, and then the Canons of Dort, which we'll look at momentarily. So in terms of how the Dutch fit into the larger question, these three confessional statements, which are very Calvinistic and but have different influences now, will be part of the fruit of what played out in Holland, and very useful to them. Now, long term, this doctrinal controversy that played out in the 17th century is going to forever refine Calvinistic thinking and produce this little acrostic we call the TULIP, or the 5 points of Calvinism, which Calvin had absolutely nothing to do with. He was long gone by the time they had this discussion. But let me just say a few things about how this discussion emerged and what took place now with this professor, this Dutch professor, Jacob Arminius. And you'll see his dates there. Well, what happened now? Okay, the Reform movement has continued, and you've got these Dutch church, very strong, close connections with the state in the north. And you've got Dutch universities, and in the University of Leiden, there is a professor named Arminius. And he is appointed in 1602 to be a professor there. There was some protest about putting him in that position. But Arminius, a very bright guy, and he had a number of students that became his followers. But some of his colleagues there at the university tried to block some of the appointments that he was in favor of, and there's some tensions that began to build. And a part of what Arminius was objecting to was it was some of the what he described as the speculation of Beza. Now, Theodore Beza, who's Calvin's successor in Geneva, had articulated a doctrine we call supralapsarianism. Well, that's a word you might use next Sunday at church and see how people look back at you. Just so you have the context, what this means in essence. Again, it's back to this whole sense of God's decrees. All right, in the word supralapsarian, the word lapsa refers to the fall. Okay, so supralapsa, before the fall, God decreed who's going to be saved and who will not. Okay, so it's a supralapsarian perspective versus some talk about an infralapsarian understanding of God's decrees, that it was only after the fall occurred that then God determined that he would save some and pass over others. Now you may think, well, that's kind of a scholastic splitting of hairs. Well, anyway, it got on the table, and Arminius was not too fond of it, and he began to raise some questions about Beza's form of Calvinism. This is the way he described it. He felt like it was so much concentration on God's decrees, it was not sufficiently Christocentric. And so he begins to talk about election being subsequent to grace. And he felt like grace comes first, and then we understand God's election. Arminius talked about God decreeing to save all who will repent and believe. And election is conditioned on the human being's response. And so a number of his students, his disciples, imbibe these ideas, and so there are groups of them here at the university. And the year after he dies, you know, it never fails that, you know, a leader who has ideas, it's what his followers do with them that ends up historically making all the difference in the world. And just like Calvin was not there at the Synod of Dort, neither was Arminius. And we talk about the Arminian-Calvinist debate, and neither one of them were even there. But there was a series of remonstrant articles. Remonstrant just means a protest. The remonstrance articles in 1610. There were 46 of Arminius's students, or disciples, if you would, and they are now ministers in the Dutch church. And they lay on the table a protest against some of the doctrines that are espoused by the Dutch church. And here are some of the points that they made, and you can see why the five points of Calvinism in response to this are laid out as they are. Number one, predestination is conditioned on a person's response being grounded in God's foreknowledge. Predestination is conditioned on a person's response being grounded in God's foreknowledge. Secondly, Christ died for each and every person, but only believers are saved. Thirdly, a person is unable to believe and needs the grace of God. Number four, but grace is resistible. And number five, whether all the regenerate will persevere requires further investigation. In other words, we're just not so sure about that one. Well, eventually a national Synod of Dort is called for, and you can see the area of Dort there, the northern provinces. And they meet together in 1618-1619. Representatives from the Netherlands, there are some theologians are invited from Switzerland, some from the Palatinate, a few from England and Scotland. So this is much more than just a Dutch contingent, although it's by far the predominant participants are there from Holland. But you've got representatives from other Reformed churches in Europe and Britain that are participating in this discussion. And they had not too favorable a view of the Remonstrant Articles, and believed that this was a semi-Pelagian view of grace, and they felt like it destroyed the doctrine of assurance by questioning perseverance, and they felt like that it became that this position became a conditioned gospel which threatens both a biblical understanding of the atonement and even justification by faith alone. So the canons of Dort, which have a lot of technical theological language in it, and but is historically been summarized by these five little points we call the tulip, and I trust most of you have heard of these before. I'm not going to go through it, but I just want to put it up there for you for in case there are any for whom these are new ideas. But essentially trying to address some of the questions that Arminius's followers, these ministers, had put forward. They challenge back in turn with affirming a notion of total depravity, that is, that all humankind has been affected by corruption in every area of life. Unconditional election, election is not based on his foreknowledge of who will believe and have faith, but it's unconditional. Limited atonement, the most controversial of them all, that the atonement is limited in that Christ died only for the elect, and essentially that was an understanding that perceived the work of the Holy Trinity and salvation is consistent with one another, as God had called some to Himself, and the Holy Spirit enlivens those whom God has called, and these are the ones that Christ gave His life for. It's like it says in John 10, the good shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. This, by the way, is going to be the one that is going to be questioned by you know, different people in the Reformed tradition over the years, is that necessarily a doctrine that you know is necessary for us to hold? Even some of the American Presbyterians would have some questions about the way some of that has been articulated. But at least these points are laid out in the 16, 18, 19. Irresistible grace, if God gives His grace, it will accomplish its purposes. And then the question had been raised about assurance, and they said, absolutely. Those who are born again, those whom God has elected, will persevere. Well, as a result of the canons of Dort, 200 clergy are divested. That means they've got to start new churches. They're banished. Some would go and build their own churches. And what you see happening now in the 17th century is a reaction back against the position of Calvinism. So I think this diagram kind of captures it. In the reaction to Roman Catholicism, to this Calvin's understanding of the doctrines of grace, and then in the Dutch church in the early decades of the 17th century, a response back in their understanding of kind of a middle ground here. Now, those of you with a Methodist heritage will certainly identify more with what the Arminian position is, because as you listen to it, why, that sounds just like Wesley's understanding of prevenient grace. Well, it certainly is. This is exactly where Wesley got it. In Wesley's little magazine, which he published, was called the Arminian Magazine. He knew very well that this was a theology that that he embraced, and so there's going to be no little ongoing debate between Calvinists and Arminians ever since the 17th century. But this is where it comes from here in Holland. And little did the Calvin and Arminius, who never met one another and weren't even present, would know that some of their ideas would have an impact. All right, a couple more things I'll just say about the 30 Years' War, and then we'll end and let y'all have your discussion groups. On the bottom, or on the middle line there, you'll see the truce with Spain, 1609, and then finally this Peace of Westphalia in 1648. And let me just put the map up here. I'm going to come back and talk about this toward the end of the course, Lord willing, if we have time. But essentially, the 30 Years' War, the three decades in which Central Europe and most of the kingdoms, nations in Europe, were involved over this 30-year period in just a horrendous, bloody conflict. It began in Bohemia, in the city of Prague. A few years ago, I was teaching a course at a little seminary in the Czech Republic. I was in Prague, and we went over to the Royal Palace, and I remember somebody pointed to me and said, "There's the window right there." And what they did is the king of Bohemia, there were a number of Protestant groups there in Bohemia, and he was trying to curtail their liberty. And there were a couple of Protestants one day got one of the Catholic officials and basically threw him out the window to his death, right there out of the palace. And that started the 30 Years' War, and the Catholic forces and the Protestant forces met at the Battle of White Mountain. Well, Protestants in Northern Europe are going to try to come to the aid of these Protestants in Central Europe. A number of the German princes are going to be involved. In a second phase, the King of Denmark, Christian the Fourth. The King of Denmark, he is going to bring his army down into more Central Europe to fight against the Catholics. And then the most successful of the Protestant leaders, the King of Sweden, Gustavus Adolphus. I don't know if you can even read that. And he was very adept at military conflict. This is some of the earliest modern warfare. We're using guns and cannons effectively, and he developed the fine art of light cavalry and light cannons, and able to outmaneuver the Catholics in many different battles. He is a good illustration of a Protestant movement deep into Europe. As long as he could keep his supply lines all the way back to Sweden, he got very deep into this area, but eventually the Catholic forces are going to move him back up. And at the end of the 30 Years' War and the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, the lines are going to be drawn almost identically again where they were at the Peace of Augsburg in 1558. So almost 100 years later, nothing has really changed. The only significant gains are going to be in more in this eastern area. So, as a part of the Counter-Reformation, some of these lands are reclaimed by Catholicism, and Protestantism is suppressed here. But other than that, there's no real significant change here. And the reason it's important for our story, and that we'll pick up later, is after all the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Protestants and Catholics that were killed during this 30-year war, Europe was not only fed up with warfare, a lot of Europeans were just fed up with the church. If this is what Christianity is about, they want nothing to do with it. And most historians say if there's any one historical event that is the beginnings of the Enlightenment, it's this. Much of the Enlightenment was a reaction to the 30 Years' War. We don't want anything to do with this. If this is religious practice, and in deism, Unitarianism, and Enlightenment ideas are going to flow out of that. We'll come back to that a little bit later on. But Holland was involved with this. Some of the battles you can see up through the Netherlands was involved, but all of Europe was involved with that.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.